Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome Nicole DeSatimi. She's a 34-year-old creative writer, a poet, and an artist from Niagara Falls, New York. She was born in a tiny town bordering Canada, only 5 minutes from the legendary falls. Nicole says she had an eye for beauty at a young age, and that included poetry. She can remember from an age as young as 6 being selected as part of the city's Young Authors Club. She was interested in lyric poetry from the time she was a preteen into her early to mid-20s and moved into creative writing and fiction in her late 20s and early 30s. In April of 2010, Nicole lost 95% of her eyesight due to a poisoned bag of heroin she had injected, and was shipped to Manhattan's Bellevue Hospital, 1,600 miles away from her city at that time, which was in South Florida. There she'd been attending an art institute for photojournalism, and she was forced to drop the courses as she began a new sober life in New York City. Her memoir, Addictarium, spotlights the struggle of staying sober after the first year of treatment is completed, and the truth about rehabilitation, including the cost of one's mental capabilities after suffering and recovering from this dreadful disease. So with that said, I'd like to welcome Nicole. Nicole, once again, how are you tonight?
I'm excellent. Very, very excited to be here and having this conversation. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
You are most welcome. So I didn't even realize this was National Recovery Month.
Yes, I know. It's a very, very important month for addicts in recovery, and I'm really, really grateful to be able to celebrate it and kind of get the word out at this moment that, you know, how imperative it is for people to try to turn their life around and really just celebrate what recovery means.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it said there are no accidents, and I'm booking for March, but I had a cancellation for today, and so serendipity stepped in, and here we are celebrating National Recovery Month.
Yes, and that's awesome. So really, really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's all about doing it not solo, but doing it with others, right?
Absolutely, sure. The unity is essential. Such a big part of recovery is really for one addict to relate to the next, and, you know, for all of us to share our stories and try to inspire and encourage other people to get better, that you can get better. Because there's just, you know, when you get to that point where you're in such a bad place and you're really in the depths of darkness, it's hard to have any kind of like motivation to think, oh, I can recover from this, I can be okay. But when you see a bunch of other people telling their stories, you're like, wait a minute, I can do it too. So I think the month is really, really great.
Well, I wondered if you'd be willing to share some of your story.
Oh, sure, of course. Well, you had touched on the fact that I had been taken from Florida into New York City. That happened in April of 2010. Just to sum it up, what had happened was I did shoot a poisoned bag of heroin that year after about 6 years of being an addict or being addicted to heroin. And unfortunately, I was in such bad shape at the time, I was not able to get to an ophthalmologist to really tackle the issue. So it took 3 or 4 weeks for me just to be able to get shipped to Manhattan, to Bellevue. And when I was, it was too late for me to be able to actually like restore any kind of vision in my right eye. But as I had told you earlier, I'm very grateful because what they didn't do was they sustained the infection. It didn't go into my left eye, and it would have. So I was just so grateful that I was, you know, left with at least one good eye, because my life would have changed completely had that not happened. So,
absolutely.
You know, I was there. Yeah, it was really, really a wake-up call for me. That was what I needed. But from that point on, after Bellevue, I spent about 2 weeks there. They did multiple surgeries. And then I was actually taken to Daytop Village, which is like the quintessential rehab in New York City. It's a therapeutic community. It's it can be from anywhere from a year to 3 years to complete, and it's very, very intensive rehabilitation. So basically, you know, I spent approximately 2 years there. I did 1 year upstate in what they call kind of like a boot campish phase, and that's when you really, really tackle the therapeutic part of it, and, you know, you kind of just are given the opportunity to do, you know, 5 or 6 groups of therapy a day and, you know, connect with all these other addicts and really, really get down to the core issues that are causing you to want to use in the first place. And then you're sent downstate. I went to Queens, New York, and they had what they call the reentry unit. That's what the book focuses on, that second year. Because, you know, the one thing that I've noticed, like with a lot of memoirs, is that, they tackle that, or they explain that first year, and they kind of go through the super, super lows, and then they go to the rehab part and they hit the super high, but nobody ever really explains what happens after. Because the thing is, after that pink cloud dissolves, now you're faced with the same problems you had before you used. So now it's how am I going to handle this? Now what am I going to do differently? And it's a very confusing time. So I really wanted to explain to people kind of like the truth about recovery. And it's this lifelong process, but it's achievable 100%. But it's something you really have to take seriously and be super dedicated to. And as you and I were talking about before, the spirituality, that part of you that has to get better and, you know, become a more spiritual person and really consider health and wellness and what those things mean to you in your life, that's what really has to be tackled. So I really tried to put a spotlight on the psyche of an addict and, you know, the ups, the downs, and the many faces of addiction. So,
well, now, did spirituality come to you naturally, or was that something you needed to work at?
You know, spirituality, I think, is something that was always within me. What I was very leery about was like organized religion, just because in the generation I've grown up in, there's been so much corruption. So that was one of those things that kind of always scared me. It's like, you don't want to be duped and you don't want to feel naive and like you're not thinking about things on an intellectual level. But the truth of spirituality isn't really something you should intellectualize. It's something that comes from within. I always believed in spirituality. I always believed that there was something bigger out there, but I needed to find a way for me to be comfortable with it, for me to be able to define it the way I felt it was or what it meant to me. So I think it was always spiritual. It was just getting to that point where I can say, okay, if I think about it on these terms, this makes sense to me, I guess, is what I'm really trying to say. But I find it very important, absolutely.
What does it mean to you?
To me, spirituality is it's kind of the thing that connects the emotional, mental, even the physical being all together in one. And it's about health and wellness and a belief in something bigger. I think that the point of spirituality is to believe that this universe is huge and there are powers that are bigger than the human being. And it's important to be in touch with that. We're not immortal. We're not invincible. What we can do is have a really great life and enjoy it and, you know, just seek some kind of content or happy living style or whatever you want to call it. But the thing with spirituality is that you have to have that in you to be able to be a happier, more content individual. Because if you don't believe there's anything bigger than you out there, that's what kind of drives people to that really, really dark place. And, you know, when you get there, it's so hard to kind of pick yourself up out of that rut. So I think spirituality is just really being in touch with the universe and understanding that we've been kind of given this great gift if we can see it that way. You know, if we can approach life as the gift it could be, it can be a really beautiful thing. So spirituality definitely has to tie into that, though.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of gratitude just listening to you talk. How important do you think gratitude is in terms of maintaining one's sobriety, or even for the non-addict, if there is such a thing? Because I once heard spiritual writer say that to be human is to be addicted. There's so many different things that we can attach ourselves to.
Sure.
People, place, things. And, you know, the only thing that really fills us up is what comes from within. So I'm wondering what role gratitude plays for you in terms of staying the course.
I mean, I think I feel immense gratitude to, you could name it a higher force. You can, you know, give it any name or tag you want. But what I feel gratitude for is that I was born. I was given this chance and this opportunity. And if you can put yourself in a good place and get a really good perspective on things, you can see that life is actually really quite beautiful. So to have gone through the addiction that I did and to have been so dark and depressed and really angry, and not understanding that this is a gift, thinking that it's some kind of hell because I had created a personal hell. So, and then I'm starting to lose my eyesight, and that was kind of my awakening. Well, for one thing, I'm an artist, so visual stimulation is, you know, my whole world. But aside from that, going blind, I mean, it would just change your whole world completely. So for me, the gratitude came from going partially blind. I kind of like woke up and realized I don't want to die. I don't know what I'm doing, but I need to stop. So when I was given the opportunity to stop and I, you know, kind of rebuilt my life, today I feel immense gratitude towards everything and anything, towards, you know, the world, life, my parents for having me and still, you know, supporting me and loving me despite what I had done, and my family, everybody, my friends, anybody who stuck by me through that, I have a lot of gratitude for. And just the world in itself, it can be a really, really beautiful place, and, you know, you can be inspiring and you can be inspired, and that's wonderful. So I think that gratitude's really big for me, actually. I think that I am really in touch with that, so it's important.
Well, the one thing I find about gratitude is it helps me raise my level of vibration and keeps me in a more positive frame of mind.
Sure.
You know, if I start to feel down, if I start counting my blessings, it raises me up. And I think it's so important to stay positive. What do you think about that?
Sure. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, these are things that I heard while I was going through my addiction. And, you know, when you're going through an addiction or anything really that's really ugly and terrible, it might not be an addiction specifically, but whatever you're going through, where you become kind of cynical and angry, you kind of laugh at these things like they're cliches and you think, oh, you know, that's what people say, but that's not really how it is. If you can get yourself in a good positive mind frame, you understand the power in that. Positive thinking is essential. I mean, I've lived through it myself and I've seen it with other people. When you are in a negative headspace, bad things happen. And when you're in a really good place, a lot of good things happen. Is it always going to be that way every day? Probably not. But overall, just getting yourself to that really good place mentally, you are also able to kind of train yourself to handle the bad things better. They don't seem quite as bad when you're in a good headspace. You kind of learn how to tackle issues and not make a big deal out of everything. I think that I'm not going to speak for every addict, but I know for myself, being very dramatic and kind of overreacting to things was a huge issue for me. And one day you kind of have to just sit down and think, I don't have to, you know, be upset about every little thing, and I don't have to react so intensely to every little thing that happens. So being in that good headspace and just really, like, keeping yourself positive and the people around you positive and walking away from negativity and not having those negative relationships, that is all essential to staying sober. And not just staying sober, but having a good life, period, if you're not an addict, you know. You have to live that way. Otherwise, if you think miserably, nothing good is going to happen. You're going to continue being miserable. So I think it's huge. And I think it has a huge impact on your physical, mental, and emotional, you know, state as well. So, yeah, very, very important, positive thinking, huge.
Well, it requires a real mind shift, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is, kind of like retraining your brain or, you know, just self-awareness, which to me is like one of the highest forms of intelligence, you know. To be self-aware is so imperative. And when you really, I think that especially with like Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, they try to teach you to what they call take personal inventory. And that's when you kind of start to have to look at yourself. And at first, it's not fun. You know, nobody wants to write 20 things that are awful about themselves, but it's not, you know, for the purpose of bringing you down. It's for self-awareness. Okay, these are some of the flaws I have, and can I change them, and do I want to, and will I acknowledge that these are the things that are really wrong with me, and why are they wrong with me, and how can I fix them, and if I can't fix them, how can I live with them? So, yeah, again, like the positive outlook and all of that, that's just so essential to your entire well-being. I really believe that. I really do.
Well, we talked a little bit about this before the show started, but can you talk about what you did to in your early recovery to create this mind shift and to begin your journey into sobriety?
Sure. Everybody has what they call their awakening or that moment. For me, it was obviously I started getting this terrible infection and my eye was all swollen and puffy and I couldn't see. And, you know, I was doing a lot of heroin and whatever else I could get my hands on at that time. And, you know, abusing myself with needles and just all these horrible things were happening. And my fiance at that time, who I'm not with anymore, but at that time, he was also very, very addicted to heroin. And so it was this, you know, relationship revolving around this really ugly thing. And so I was in a really bad place, to sum it up, a really, really negative space. And I just remember one day I'm sitting on the shower floor and, you know, it was a day where we hadn't been able to get something. So I was sick on top of everything else. And I had covered all the mirrors in the house because I didn't want to look at myself because with the infection, I had started kind of going cross-eyed for a little bit. It's not like that anymore, but it was while I was sick with the infection because my eye had to be covered so much. It was like kind of almost going lazy, I guess. So I didn't want to look at myself in the mirror. I didn't want to, but I forced myself to that day. And I mean, when I saw myself staring back at me and, you know, my hair's kind of like in mats and, you know, I have this huge swollen eye and I'm like 90 pounds if even that at the time. I was so thin and pale and I didn't even recognize myself. And I just thought, I can't do this anymore. So I called my mother. I remember this so clearly. And I'm just crying. I'm like, I don't want to die. I can't do this anymore. And my mom said to me, you know, you can't, because I had tried to do these, like, you know, 1 week detoxes and things like that. And she said, you need intensive rehab. You need to find a place that's going to take you for a while and really reform your life. And I'm like, she's right. So I did do the detox. And when I went to the detox, this is when this whole thing kind of kicked in. My eye was terribly infected. They sent me to Manhattan, you know, Bellevue and the daytop. So, for me, that was kind of like where the journey began. It took something like very dramatic for me to really wake up, but I know that there's people who that may not have even woken them up. Some people need even more than that. And for me, that was the end. I just had gotten to the point where I didn't love heroin anymore. I actually hated it. So it was like, you know, this is just stop. And I took a look at my life and everything that was going on around me, and I'm not having any meaningful relationships anymore. And, you know, that's essential to life. To me, human relationships are the most important aspect of living. And I didn't have any of that. I was just, you know, living so vapid and just in a really, really bad place. So I had this awakening. I ended up in daytop, and, you know, I had a lot of struggles. And in the book, Addictarium, you will see that it was not, you know, it wasn't all roses for me. I didn't just go to rehab and suddenly I was fine. It was a really big uphill mountain to climb for me. And after that first year, especially when I came back down, there was a lot that happened and I still needed to learn a lot of lessons. But one thing I knew for sure was that I could never shoot heroin again. I knew that. But what I had to come to terms with was that I couldn't do anything else. Because you had mentioned before, it's not just like one addiction, or, you know, addiction has so many faces. And for me, I had realized that it wasn't just using heroin. I had all these other terrible habits and addictions and, you know, like self-mutilation or pain or whatever it may be. And I had to get better the whole way around. I had to do serious therapy and really get my mind, my body, emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually, everything in sync together into a better place, because I did not want to use heroin or anything anymore. So it kind of was like a slap in the face for me. I really needed something rough to happen, basically. So,
well, that leads me to my next question, which you more or less answered, and that is, how important do you think it is for an addict to hit a real low bottom?
I think that it probably depends on the level of addiction you're facing, but I think that most addicts need something quite alarming to hit. And that's unfortunate because it could be something really awful, like someone you love overdosed, or you know, it could be something really terrible. But a lot of people have to have that like moment that just kind of like smacks you in the face, and you are given that choice: do I want to live or do I want to die? Because this is what it's coming down to. And you know, we all say we're miserable and I don't even care if I wake up tomorrow, but nobody really means that. Most people don't, at least. And so there's like the saying on the street, especially with heroin addicts, they say you get to that point where they call it a hope to die junkie, where every time you stick the needle, you don't want to wake up. And I really thought I was there. But when I started going blind and everything, and I'm sitting on this floor thinking I just can't do this anymore, I'm like, wait a minute, I don't want to die. I actually want to live, and I want to be able to, you know, pursue this thing that we call life and make it wonderful and all these things that I know it could be. So, most addicts that are really, really deep in addiction do kind of need that huge slap or kick. And it's unfortunate, but I think that it's kind of essential.
Yeah, I do too. I think that we need wake-up calls in this life to change our lives and turn them around. And what kind of hope can you hold out to somebody that's deep in addiction and deep in denial? What would you say to that person?
That's a very tricky one, especially when somebody's still in that denial phase. I've been through it myself, and I've met a lot of people like that where their life is really falling apart, but they just don't want to face it, that they have no control left over this thing. And you can't force someone out of denial, I guess. It's really tricky. It's really tricky to get help for somebody if they haven't gotten there themselves. I would say is, a lot of people think like tough love is the method. To me, like, it is on one hand, but on the other hand, as long as you're not enabling, but you're still supporting the person who is addicted, you have to show them love. One of the biggest things and biggest problems with addiction is the addict doesn't feel loved. It's a huge part of the problem. There's this gaping hole they're trying to fill, and, you know, they feel some kind of insecurity or whatever, just not feeling loved or not feeling cared for at the moment. And I don't know if tough love is the answer, because sometimes that makes an addict want to use more. I do think, however, that you can't enable an addict. You can't be like, okay, you can live here forever and I'll give you money just so you're safe. And no, you can't do that either, obviously. But for me, like, the way I would try to handle an addict, I mean, you can't force it. I would say just be there, support them, and show them you love them no matter what they do, because they're going to try to push you away because they're embarrassed about using and they can't stop, and they know that's the truth deep down somewhere, and they might do mean things because they're just so disappointed in themselves and ashamed, you know, so they're pushing everyone away. But you really, if you love someone, you've really got to stick by them in those times and just keep reminding them that you love them, and, you know, also try to help them for real. Like, one of my biggest problems was I had no idea where to go. Everywhere in Florida, it was all private. I didn't have the money for it. You know, I would see these shows on TV where they send you to rehab, and I'm like, I'm so desperate. I'm like, should I write a letter into these shows? Because I just didn't know what to do. But finally, I had gotten my chance when I went to detox, and they had talked about this program in New York City where they would be able to, you know, get me the right health care so that I could get right in, and it was long, and they really help you reform your whole life. So what another thing that I have not read a lot in memoirs about drug addiction is the therapeutic community, which is what I was in. They get a bad rap sometimes because there's a little bit of corruption that goes on sometimes in those type of government-funded places. But the thing about a long-term intensive program is they give you every tool you need. I mean, there's so many great things about those programs. And I guess with everything, there's like good and bad. But what they do provide to you, first of all, you have your living quarters. You have tons of therapy. You get a therapist, a psychoanalyst, a counselor, tons of addicts in recovery who are there to help you and guide you. So, and then they have all these different groups for any kind of trauma you might have gone through. I think that if I've met somebody who was really, really down and they just didn't know what to do, my answer would be to look into something like that, because that's what worked for me. And I was one of those people who didn't know where to go, didn't have the money to do it, and I just was really lost. I was like, I don't want to use anymore, but I don't know what to do. So I guess stepping up and really supporting the person, not like the tough loving, like, no, I'm not going to help you, you need to figure this out on your own. I don't think that's really the approach, honestly. So like I said, support, information, love, those are key.
Well, that's a great message, and I think you were really blessed to have found your way to that particular program.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your book, Addictarium. What was your inspiration for writing it?
Well, I've been writing since I was small, as you had, you know, spoken about. And so I always knew I wanted to write, and I'd always been writing regularly, just different things, you know, poetry, short stories, whatever, journaling all the time. I knew I wanted to write a novel eventually, but I wasn't sure exactly what it was. The thing was, when I went to Data Village, and then I went through this whole experience, it kind of hit me in the face. Like, this is something you need to share. This is the story right here. This is the way to turn your life into a work of art, but also to help people, to really inspire and to get the message out there that this is possible. If I did it, anybody can do it. Trust me when I tell you that. So I think that writing Addictarium for me, there was so many different things I wanted to really convey to the world. I wanted to tell a great story because I'm a writer, and I wanted to write a great story. That's definitely part of it. I'm not going to say it's not, but I think that my message was really, like, I wanted to be real and authentic. I didn't want some contrived story that just sounds good. You know, I wanted people to understand that there's this huge process, and they call you recovering forever for a reason. There's no automatic cure, and it doesn't stop. You have to work at it every single day of your life, but that's overwhelming. So people don't want to tell people that because they think that will discourage them. What they do tell you to do is try to take that lifelong process and condense it down to one day at a time, which is brilliant because that actually works. So for me, it was just like, I'm thinking in my head, I have so much to say. And, you know, I met all of these amazing people who now I call characters because they're characters in my book, but they were real people. And, you know, the thing about the addiction world is you have some really interesting people. There's a lot of creative people. There's a lot of people who have a lot of potential. So I just felt like I could inspire, I could tell my story, I could help people, I can write, which I love to do. And on top of that, you know, I had, on top of, you know, there was some bad experiences, but I had some really amazing ones as well. And, you know, there was different people I connected with and different things that happened that to me were really interesting, if not anything else. And I just kind of wanted to put all of that together into one book and, you know, tell this great story, but this great story really happened. So hopefully somebody can learn from it and understand that, oh, wow, this is a really difficult thing I have to do, but maybe, you know, this person, look, she went through hell. She barely, you know, made it at some points, but she did. So hopefully I can too, you know? So I guess it's just like my message is to keep fighting no matter how discouraged you feel or how alone you feel or desperate or depressed, because I've done all of those things to the maximum and I still was able to come out of it. So I really want people to grasp that.
How similar is your protagonist, Danielle Martino, to yourself?
Danielle Martino is actually the character, obviously, is representative of me. I would say 90% of her personality, as well as what happened in the story, was true to life. I did write it as fictional because I did have to combine some characters and combine some situations and kind of embellish to tell the story with a good flow. But Danielle Martino is pretty much, she's close, very, very close to who I actually am as a person. The thing that's different about my character and me is, it was a long time ago that this is happening. This was like 6 years ago now. And at that time, I was in my 20s. So, you know, she's very naive in some ways. And you see that in the book. I mean, she's definitely deep and, you know, she's thoughtful and you can see that she wants to be spiritual, but she is naive. I think that me personally, at least at this point in my life, I don't feel like I carry that naive anymore with me. So when you see or read the character, you're kind of seeing like an older version of me. And also she was, but I tell people the character Danielle Martino is actually in character. That's who I was at the time. When you are in these kind of places where there's, you know, 150 people suffering from various mental disorders, substance abuse, some of them are felons who were supposed to go to jail, but, you know, they didn't have room, so they put them in these programs. So you have all these, build a wall. And I think for me, being so different, especially in kind of like an oddball, I kind of went into character to protect myself at the time. You know, I developed this like character around myself, and that's what people knew me as. And I think it was really just a form of protection for me. And so when you are reading about this character, Danielle Martino, she seems very histrionic at times. And I think I was at that time, you know, so it made it for a great story. I think that I'm a little bit more authentic in real life, probably more real. But I would say that her thoughts, her psychology and her struggles are 100% what I went through. Those things are accurate. So
What slice of life is covered in the book?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? I didn't hear that.
Well, what slice of your life is covered in the book?
Oh, what slice of my life? Well, like I said
or
before,
the character's
again,
life.
I would say about at least 85% of what's written actually happened verbatim. That 15% window is for the times I had to cut something short or, you know, change a few characters or combine some people. So I wrote it as a fictional memoir based on true stories to let people know, you know, some things were a little bit different. But for the most part, that story and the awakening and the rehab and, you know, the struggles and despair, that all is 100% accurate. And the cool thing about the book also is that the people that are still in my life who were characters in the book, you know, they're fine with the things I've written. They know all about it, and so they're fine. Some of them, like, I actually use their real dialogue, like, especially with my substance abuse counselor, who I later ended up with as, you know, a mate. He and I had such great dialogue between us. We text and wrote letters and talked on the phone and everything so frequently that we had created this really beautiful dialogue. So I wanted to really get that through in the book, how special and unique and beautiful it was. It was very poetic. So what I did was I kept a lot of the things that we wrote and said, and I, you know, I told them I want to use this for the book or I want to use that for the book. And, you know, so there's still conversations in there. They seem very poetic and, you know, almost like a movie, but those things really happened, which is kind of awesome, you know? So.
Yeah. What did they think about your writing this book?
See, now everybody's very supportive and happy. The thing about the book is it's a tough read. There's a lot of things that happen in it that are very scary, especially if somebody's related to me or they know me personally and they care about me. I think that it would be very hard to read the book in that sense. But when you see the passion I put in writing it and the story I'm trying to tell and you know, from the beginning to the end, the transformation or the metamorphosis, it's you can't help but kind of be inspired a little bit, I think. And for family, I think it's hard just because so many bad things did happen. Even while I was in rehab, you know, there were some real traumatic events that took place, and they were scary and awful. And I don't think that anybody that loves me or that I love would want to read that, but overall, the book itself, the story itself is really important. So I've been blessed with people who have been supportive, regardless of how gritty it can be at times, you know, a little bit raw, a little bit gritty, but they're still kind of like they're supporting me. And I know that's tough. So I kind of feel bad sometimes. I'm like, you know, there was part of me that really wanted to edit it and make it more toned down. But on the other hand, I was like, but I need people to grasp how real this is. And sometimes you have to get a little bit raw to get that point across to people, you know? So it's a difficult thing. I kind of go back and forth with it, you know? Like, on one hand, I'm really grateful that they've all accepted it and they like it. But on the other hand, I feel really guilty that they had to read something that was so awful for them to, you know, hear. Or so I don't know. I kind of go back and forth, I guess.
Well, I can relate to that. I've written my own memoir, and it was difficult for people that I was close to read. So
exactly.
I can relate to that as well.
Yeah.
How is your memoir different from similar drug memoirs?
Well, as I spoke of before, first of all, the therapeutic community is not something I've seen written about, and I'm really shocked that it hasn't been, because in New York City, there's a lot of therapeutic communities, and this is something that in New York, pretty much if you are dealing with addiction, you're probably going to end up in a therapeutic community at some point. So I was shocked that I never heard about them when I was in Florida. I had never heard about these type of places, and when I got to New York, it's like this, like kind of like the secret, and then it's like, oh, everybody knows about them, everybody talks about them, but you don't really hear it outside of that circle. So, you know, it's different for that reason. It was 2 years, and then the year I actually focused on was the second year of rehab, which I haven't seen many people do. A lot of people tend to write the very end of their addiction and then the road to recovery part. I kind of went past that, and I did, you know, I did like go back and explain some things that had happened and kind of went back and forth a little bit, but most of it is forward movement in time. It's a, you know, the forward tale of addiction. Okay, I've been sober for 1 year. I feel great about that, but now what, you know? So it's kind of like that point where you're a little bit undecided. You don't know where you want to take your life at that point, and you have to, you have to be able to deal with the trauma and all those things that happened that caused you to use in the first place. So now you're not only are you fighting to stay sober and you're dealing with your addiction and what that may have caused and damage and whatnot. Now you're also, you got these things that caused you to use in the first place you have to deal with and kind of unravel and get rid of that scar tissue and whatnot. So I've read a lot of drug abuse and recovery memoirs, but I haven't read many that really touch on that part of it. So I thought that was really important. I wanted to kind of paint the road you go down past the point of, okay, I went to rehab and it's been a while now. Now what? So, and plus the reentry unit, again, with being in the therapeutic community, I haven't read many books where somebody talked about going like into, you know, kind of like a reentry unit, which was what we called it. And it's basically, you could say it's almost like a homeless shelter, except for there's tons of therapy provided for addicts. There's like 160 or so people who live there, and they give you the opportunity to go to get some kind of vocational training, or you can get a job and save up while you're living there. And you have about a year or two to do that, depending on what plan they design for you. And so that was different to me. I felt like I was touching on something kind of new. And also, this is the other thing that's very, very different about my book. I really get into the personality and perhaps even the disordered personality type of an addict. It touches on kind of like the narcissism and personality disorders. And I believe that addiction can be genetic. I believe it can be conditioning. I believe that many things can trigger it. But there is a distinct personality that seems to be more prone to using. So what I wanted to do was really unravel that too. The psychology of someone who people think may be selfish and thoughtless, but you really, very rarely is that the case. So I wanted to show people that we're not selfish. It's not that we don't care about anyone. For the most part, most of us care too much, and that's kind of what causes us to go into that, you know, mode of, I want to numb myself, I can't take this. So the psychological aspect of addictarium, I would say, is 100% like different from anything that I've seen, at least so far.
Well, it sounds like it's a really interesting read. Now, the book just came out at the beginning of the month. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And where's the best place? Okay, and where's the best place for people to get a hold of it?
Right now, it's on one platform only. I am going to have it on multiple platforms soon, but right now it's on Amazon.com. It's available as an ebook as of now. The paperback will be coming out later in the year or probably early 2017. But right now there is an ebook available. There's an expurgated version, also a censored version for much, much younger people. I feel like if parents want to teach their children about, you know, drug addiction, I put that out there for them to give them that chance without something that's so raw and, you know, uncensored. But so there's two versions. You can get the regular original uncut or the expurgated version as ebooks on Amazon.com. All you have to do is look up either Addictarium, which is spelled Addictarium, or you can look it up under author Nicole DeSatini, and it should come right up.
Okay. Would you like to spell your name, too?
Sure. Yeah. You spell Nicole, N-I-C-O-L-E for Nicole, and then DeSatini is D-apostrophe-S-E-T-T-E-M-I, and you got it. It should come
now,
right up.
Now, do you have a website, Nicole?
I do. I have a website specifically for Addictarium, which has a lot of information and interviews and just it's chock full of stuff about Addictarium specifically. So you can actually, I'm still building and launching it, but right now it's available at this address. It's available at Addictarium, spelled how I just spelled it, addictarium.wix.com, and then /home. That will probably be changing soon, but as of right now, for the next couple of months, that is where you would go if you want to find out more about Addictarium. And the website really breaks down a lot of different things about the characters, and there's photos and different things included. So, I would definitely say go there if you want to learn a little bit more about the book.
Great. Well, what's your favorite thing about being a writer?
Oh, wow. That question is... there's so many things I love about writing. When I initially started writing when I was young, I didn't really understand why I was doing it because I was like 6 or 7, but I was writing these little like philosophical poems and stuff. So I guess I was always kind of like reflective. But as I got older in my teens and, you know, my young adult years, it helped to alleviate pain at that time. It was an outlet to feel some of that anger and, you know, whatever I was feeling at the time onto paper. And then I felt like once I did that, I could kind of move forward. Okay, I've gotten this out now. Now I can move forward. And then as I got older, I just really started to understand the beauty in the art of writing and what it truly means and is. You know, I started studying people like legends like Anais Nin and Henry Miller and these wonderful writers. And I said, oh, my God, I've always loved writing, but I'm starting to really approach it at this artistic level and really understanding the art of telling a story and, you know, the art of writing beautiful prose. So I think that what I really love about writing now is it's this opportunity to kind of go into a different world, I guess, and it's your own world, and you can do anything that you want with it, and, you know, nobody can really touch that or take that from you, so you have this opportunity to take yourself into another place and do whatever you want with it and just be as creative as possible. The more creative, the more amazing, so it's a cool way to take these abstractions and these thoughts that we have and to articulate them to the rest of the world. I think that's really special. And I also think that with writing, people can just learn so much. I love the aspect of, you know, knowledge and what writing a great book can really do for the world. So there's writing to me, writing and art both are probably the closest things to divinity because they're creation. So I really appreciate that aspect of it. There's a lot of freedom with that.
Do you have future writing plans?
Yes, I do. I'm already starting to outline probably a prequel to Addictarium. I do want to kind of touch on the part of Addictarium the first year, which was upstate New York. And like I said, they called it like the boot camp phase. I would really like to explain that because the difference was I was with 72 women. It was not co-ed. At that time, I was still engaged to my co-conspirator, my partner in crime, and he had actually left me on the day of my third eye surgery. He went back to Florida with some woman that he met 2 or 3 days before. Now, mind you, he and I had been engaged for 6 years, so that was a really traumatic event in my life. I had been, you know, trying to restore my vision and get off heroin, and here I am. I'm going to surgery, and I told the day of at 5 o'clock in the morning that my fiancé left the other program he was in because he was in a different one that was near ours. It was a co-ed one that was still part of Daytop, but it was a separate building. And so I found that out, and I was really, really, like, devastated. So part one is really going to focus more on that and kind of, like, what brought me down to reentry, and the part two, the part I wrote now, Addictarium, what brought me there and the psychological place I was at. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm also working on something else. It's going to be a psychodramatic thriller. It's going to be very psychological. The name of it is Narcissopia, and it's really going to dig deep into personality disorders and things like that. And kind of like when people are living in kind of like a delusional world, you're going to get the different viewpoints and kind of like the truth and illusion thing. I want to like write something that kind of, you know, shows that thin line between truth and illusion and different personalities and how that affects different lives. So those are the two things I'm really looking forward to writing at this point.
Oh, that's great. I love that title, Narcissopia.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I thought, you know, I mean, really, and it's a very interesting disorder to read about and learn about. In the addiction world, there are many people who are suffering from different personality disorders, especially like narcissism and borderline disorder and all of these things. So I had met a lot of people like this, and I had just started to do my own private little study. You know, I'm certainly not a doctor, but I had started to document the different personality types, the different things people say, and the different delusions when you hear two people who are telling the same story, but, you know, it's like you see it from their viewpoint, and you're like, wow, if you only knew what that person was thinking, you know. So you meet these different people who really believe life is a certain way, and then the question becomes, what is real and what is illusion? So I really wanted to dig deep into that and kind of center it around 2 or 3 main characters, and you know, just having this kind of like what society takes a personality disorder and how it affects their lives and each other. So yeah, that one was, I'm really looking forward to writing that.
Well, I wish you luck with both of those books. It sounds like some very exciting endeavors. Now, you are also an artist. And
yes.
Tell me what kind of art you pursue.
I actually, with art, see, I pursue anything that I actually can, which doesn't really explain it, but my fiance and I, he lives in Poughkeepsie, and we have like we turned our living studio into an art studio as well. So, you know, the entire living room of our place is kind of like a full art studio, and he is a painter, and I have just started painting these last 2 years. So I do painting. I do sketch art. I do illustrations. I like arts and crafts. I have a whole, you know, huge thing of arts and craft supplies against one wall. And I just kind of, whatever I feel like doing that day, jewelry or jars, whatever it may be. So that's just kind of fun. But there's things I do that are, I guess you wouldn't call them fine arts or arts, but to me, they're still creative. Like, I love web design. I offer that service to people. Graphic arts, I love doing. Anything kind of creative, I guess. Even, like, fashion, I take it and approach it creatively and try to, like, you know, pretty much anything I do, I kind of do, like, in an artistic way or try to. So, yeah, I mean, basically everything. I can't think of one thing. I love shooting photography. That's another one. So it's, like, there's not really a limit to what I do. I guess it's just what have I learned how to do at this point. So...
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. I'm one of those people who kind of, I'm better at teaching myself than someone else teaching me. So I just read a lot of books and practice things until I can do them. And then it's like, okay, now I understand this. But my fiance in New York, he is a wonderful, wonderful painter. And he taught me how to draw very well. See, I was very into abstract art, and I still am. I swear by it. It's the most creative work. I love it. I understand it. I just, you know, I really enjoy abstract work. But he taught me realism, which was something that I kind of, and I shouldn't have been this way, but I was like, oh, I don't want to learn that. You know, there's no creativity in drawing something exactly how it looks. But he taught me how to do it, and I really thoroughly enjoy doing it now sometimes, you know, just sketching a face or whatever it may be. So, yeah, it's kind of like I try to delve into everything and just really learn and grow and expand the mind, especially artistically. That's super, super therapeutic. So I've learned that, you know, art can be a form of salvation if you want to approach it that way.
Now, how long have you been an artist?
Oh, God. Well, I've been creative my whole life, I guess, and especially to me, writing is definitely an art. So I told you before, obviously, I've been doing that for a really long time. As far as, like, other types of or other forms of art, probably seriously approaching it for the last 6 or 7 years, you know, really, really approaching, like, art and fine art from a more serious angle, I guess you could say. But
I've always
been pretty creative.
Was that also a gift of recovery for you?
Yes. Well, the thing is, when I was using, I wrote a lot. I wrote a lot, and I did draw and things like that. But you can see, a lot of people seem to think that, you know, if you use, you have all this inspiration. But if you look at my work from when I was on, you know, using drugs to when I was sober, my work when I was sober is remarkable. You can't compare the two. So I think that, it gives you some kind of creativity and opens up that door in your mind or whatever. But I think that when you're sober, you're absolutely at your best, because art itself can be something that you approach from, like, that intense angle of loving doing it and having to do it every day. And, you know, when you have time to do that because you're not doing other things that are destructive, you can really do some amazing things. And I don't believe, like, you're born an artist. I think that some people can be born more creative, and I think conditioning can play a huge part in that too. But I think anybody can do something artistic if they really try. Most people just believe they can't, so they don't try. But it's a lot more achievable than people think.
I agree. Well, how is your art different now that you're sober?
Well, when I was using, I mean, my writing was very sad. It wasn't that it was bad. It was just very, very depressing. It certainly wasn't going to inspire anybody. It was really dark and sad. And, you know, just my writing, especially my poetry, was just about this young woman who hates life and, you know, is just ripping her hair out, trying to figure out why she's here. What is her reason for being here? And why do I have this, you know, these crazy thoughts going on in my head all the time, and other people seem perfectly fine in this bubble? And it's just like, I don't want to say I was envious of it, but it's like I couldn't understand why I felt so overwhelmed by life and other people. It didn't affect them that way. And then I had to accept that I'm a very intense person. That's just who I am. But, you know, so when I was doing, like, art and drawing and writing, it was very dark, and some of it was quite disturbing, quite frankly. When I got sober, or when I, you know, achieved sobriety, it's so much more. It talks about the bad times, a lot of my work or my writing, or even what I paint. You know, it will show you some of the rougher times, but there's always that that window of, or that cloud, you know, that illuminates around it, because you're sober now. So there's something great to tell at the end of every story instead of it just being dark and depressing. So I think that it's just more inspiring. And quite frankly, I have more focus. So I think that's a big one too. I'm able to actually, you know, sit down and write something and not worry about having to do this or that, or am I sick? Or so it's just more time. And the more time you put into something and the more you hone a skill, the better it's going to get. So I just think that being sober, it gives you that energy, because you're not wasting that energy on using. So you have all this new energy to put into making wonderful, beautiful creations and abstractions for the world. So yeah, I just think that, you know, like I said, focus and everything, you just have a better chance of doing something really great.
Oh, that's wonderful. What? Tell me about your writing regime.
I try not to, see, the thing with writing is I try not to give myself too many rules. I've always believed with writing I needed a lot of freedom. When I was very young, my father, you know, he would always say I should take up writing professionally, and from the time I was small, and I never really listened to it, thought about it at that time, because I loved doing it, and I didn't want to approach it as a job or something I had to do where it would become commercial, and it wasn't really, you know, it didn't really show who I was, or, you know, I didn't want to go through any of that. I didn't want to. I take my work so seriously, and I did not want to put something out there that wasn't 100% me. So I struggled with that for many years, thinking, no, I'm going to keep this as a hobby or something that I'm an enthusiast of, even though I do it seriously, because I don't want to, you know, conform and have to do something that isn't 100% me. So, funny enough, I ended up growing up in this generation where people are a lot more free with writing now, you know, and there's way more opportunities to publish now. So I'm really, really blessed in that aspect too, that I grew up in this time period where there are ebooks, there are self-publishing companies, and there are a lot of people who are utilizing it. It's not, you know, looked at as something negative as much anymore. So my regimen actually for writing, though, I try to do it every day. That's the one kind of rule I have, but I don't tell myself how I have to do it. I don't set up a time. I don't have like a time period. What I tell myself is to do some type of writing every single day, and when it comes, it comes. If it's 4 o'clock in the morning and I wake up and I have a thought, I get up and I write it. If it's, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, if it's 12 o'clock at night, if it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I try to keep a notebook on me. If I'm at home, I have my laptop or whatever open at all times and ready, and then scraps everywhere. I mean, I will jot down stuff that I think is good material on a post-it note if I have to. So writing, I do as it comes. I try not to give myself any kind of real structure with it, just that I tell myself I have to do it all the time and keep honing it, but don't, like, you know, I don't want to be like from 7 to 9 in the morning I have to write, because that's when that really causes writer's block is what it does. So, you know, I'm a high anxiety person already, so I don't need anything else making me, you know, shut down. So I try to be very open with it, you know. And then if I can't write, I try to do something else creative that day. Some other type of art, if I can't. I say, okay, well, just do something creative to keep yourself going. So.
What kind of advice would you give to an aspiring writer?
My best advice for an aspiring writer is to, I don't want to speak in cliches, but of course, is to obviously write all of the time. You have to. It's not, you know, that's not something people just say. You actually really do have to hone your skills constantly if you want to be taken seriously and do really good work. I don't know what everybody's goals are for writing, but I know, like, for me, it's really important for me to be proud of my work, and, like, I put something out there amazing versus just, oh, is this going to sell? So I think that honing it is absolutely imperative. Study other writers. I met people who say they don't, and they love to write, but I understand that everybody's interested in every writer out there, but you have to study some good writers. I mean, it's the mind expansion and what happens to you when you do that is something I don't even know how to put into words. When I was introduced to Anna Yuzmin, her writing changed my life. I started to write in this completely different, professional but beautiful and poetic way, and everything just changed for me. And that's when I was really able to write a book, because suddenly I had gotten this grasp on writing and what you can really do with it. So the other thing I would say is don't be so quick to, you know, be worried about self-publishing or not getting a writing deal or an agent. In today's world, self-publishing is huge. And it does have a stigma. You know, some of it's not taken seriously because some people are not writing as much for writing as they are, you know, to get books out there, sell them or whatever. But if you work hard and you write something amazing and you keep working, you can't give up. I'm talking about 5, 10, whatever many years it takes. You have to keep you have to keep doing it, pushing it, honing it, and taking it seriously, not ever giving up no matter what anybody tells you. I've been laughed at in the past for saying I was writing a book. People thought it was delusional. You know, they just don't believe it until it's actually done and you've done it. You know, so I would say you have to have very thick skin. Don't worry about what other people think. If this is something you have passion for, absolutely approach it and do it. It can be amazing for you if you are serious about it and really love to do it. Don't worry about society. Don't make yourself happy. You know, create. Don't destroy, because that's what happens to the creative soul when people try to shut them down and tell them, you know, you have to live this other life, this structured 9-to-5 life, doing this or that or whatever. For the creative person, that's like killing them. You're shutting them down and telling them that they can't use their imagination, and that is the thing that drives a creative person. So they end up very angry most of the time and rebellious. The way to not become rebellious is to keep creating and to hone that and to prove to yourself and to everyone else, or not even prove, just because you already know it when it's there, but just to show people that you're serious about it, and nobody's going to take that from you. Nobody's going to take your dream from you, and they shouldn't. And they shouldn't want to if they know you and they love you. So my advice, I kind of went on a tangent there, but my advice is basically keep writing, hone your skills, and don't be afraid to self-publish, because I do think that in today's day and age, if you work hard and you put something amazing out, it does not matter who the publisher is at this point. Those are my top things.
Thank you. Well, how important is it to edit and rewrite a book?
Oh, editing is huge. I mean, that's the thing that I think gives self-publishing a really bad stigma, is that some people aren't using editors, and when they're not using editors, some of them aren't even using a word check or spell check or anything. You can see it. I mean, there are books that are put out that the grammar is really unprofessional. I don't want to say it in a rude way, but it's just, so what it does is it gives people this idea that every person who self-publishes is not good enough to actually be published by someone else, and that's not necessarily the case. Some people just understand the angles of writing in the writing world, and they know what they need to do for them, especially if it's unique. This was the problem with some of the great writers of our century. I mean, Henry Miller and Anna Yeezy, my God, those two, it took them 30 years to publish books, and they're two of the greatest writers of our times. So self-publishing can be a great thing if you take it seriously. Editing is essential. You have to have somebody else look it over. I mean, you might think you've wrote the most brilliant piece of work, but if you're not up for criticism and you don't have someone else looking at it, that's setting yourself up for failure. You need second, third, and fourth opinions. That's to me, that's essential. If you can't afford an editor, when I was sitting out, I did not have the money to be putting into this at that time. So I did have some good friends who did things like proofreading professionally and people who were reporters for papers and things like that. And I asked them to read it and look it over and point out some things that needed to be changed. And they did. They helped me to mold it into something that was really, really wonderful. And then one of my best friends, she was a proofreader for Vanity Fair for years. So she helped me look it over and make sure that, you know, there was no major editing mistakes in it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you can't afford professional services, at least reach out, make connections with people, and see what you can get done. Sometimes you can barter services, you know. People are willing to do that a lot now. But definitely edit. Definitely reread your material. Do not rush it. It doesn't matter how fast it takes you to write it or how slow. Make sure when you're in that point where you wrote your last sentence that you are looking it over, over, and over and over again. I have read my book probably 100 times over, and I'm being serious. So, it's just essential. You can't just write something and throw it out there. That's not going to work. It's not going to. It has to be taken very seriously and really, really something that you have to pay attention. You know, the details matter in writing a lot, so.
Well, Nicole, we've come to the end of the hour, and I thank you so much.
Oh, already?
Yeah, that was amazing. It was a great hour.
I didn't even realize it was done.
You packed a lot of information into the hour.
Thank you so much.
A lot of hope for recovery to people.
Oh, thank you. I'm really excited that I was on your show. I mean, I thought it was wonderful. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm really grateful.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Have a good night, everyone.
Okay. So once again, we come to a close. Now let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night and God bless.